episode of We Talk Comics number 167, an epic episode. I'm Mo, the Crown Prince of Charisma, and I got Brett, the Chief Defender of the Faith.
We are Defenders of the Faith.
Well, you are. Me? I'm just all Crown Princey and Charisma. And Keith, of course, he's all Cup Reporter and K-ing.
I'm more of an Assistant Defender of the Faith.
Yeah. And the man with no nickname, Chris. And Chris, this is your episode. Tell us about the topic.
Quite simply, I was reading old comic books, big surprise, and I was reminded of what I consider probably the most important comic book imprint of all time. And I wanted to know what your guys' favorites are, and I thought we could share them on the episode. Of the imprint, of course, being Epic Comics, an imprint of Marvel Comics created in 1982 and lasted into the mid-90s. There's been a couple resurgences of it, but none of them have really stuck. But there are so many good books and groundbreaking books in this line. I think I saw my first painted book, my first mature reader's book from this line. There was so much awesome stuff. I just wanted to share that love.
There is a lot of awesome stuff in this. And I think that there's not only is there a lot of awesome, but it's odd because there's stuff that you don't think about as being epic, but there's, you know, epic seemed to have gone through so many different lives almost, you know, because you had it when it started, then it kind of went through the superhero part, and then, you know, you had the heavy hitters stuff, and there's just been, you know, you have all the little subsets like Archie Goodwin's, what was that called? The Shadow Line.
They tried to relaunch basically Marvel from a creator-owned imprint. It was bizarre, but wonderful. You have fantasy, you have sci-fi, you have satirical, you have humor. And they also reprinted books from Europe.
Yeah, that's right. And there's also, you know, the creators are just astronomical. They're so amazing.
Yeah, no, I was trying to pick out favorites, and I actually ended up picking emotional favorites rather than there are so many good books it was impossible to choose on quality alone that I just sort of went, you know what, these books are important to me, these are the ones I'm going to talk about, rather than, you know, trying to rank them.
Well, one of the things that Mo and I were talking about a little bit earlier was that we were thinking we could have used more time to prepare for this, because there's so many good books that we'd like to have been able to do more research instead of just being able to have the week and only be able to read, you know, a little bit.
It's interesting, Chris, that as you were introducing, you said, you know, the most important imprint in history. And my initial reaction was, oh, come on, Vertigo is more important. And then immediately I started thinking, but Vertigo probably couldn't have happened without Epic breaking that ground. The mix of company-owned mature readers, creator-owned mature readers books, out of continuity books. These were all tailored for the direct market. That's really what Epic was created for, was to capitalize on the direct market, which was just hitting its established point in the early 80s at the time that Epic was founded.
Not to mention, I think Epic has it on Vertigo in sheer diversity of titles. Because at a certain point, I think Vertigo did get stuck in their we're sort of horror, but not really zone for a long time. They had a lot of some excellent same, but still you don't have the switching channels between, let's say, Gru and, I don't know, Six from Sirius.
Yeah, and part of that is, I mean, as incredible an editor as Karen Berger was, and you know the other folks that worked with her, Alyssa Quitney and others. It's still a very small group who was making those decisions, and I mean certainly there was also a small group when Epic started, but as Brett said, there were many iterations of Epic over the years, and they drifted into. I mean, they were really used as a mature readers section, the way that you know later Marvel Knights was and Marvel Max were.
Yeah, I actually was unaware of the 2003 relaunch until I was researching this episode. Supposedly, it was all reimaginings of Marvel heroes out of continuity, of which I've read none, and from what I can tell, maybe one was published.
I think Trouble was Trouble and maybe one or two more.
Yeah,
were the only ones that actually came out, and Trouble was massively rewritten.
See, I've never even heard of Trouble.
I'd only heard of it because of what would have been if the book had not been reworked. I mean, the basic idea, the big crux of Trouble was that you would find out that Aunt May was actually Peter's biological mother. Other than that, like, that's kind of the big shock of it.
That would have thrown some people for a loop.
Yeah. Other than that, I don't think there was very much that actually came out from that that redo.
Well, and it's obvious, I think, that by that point, the attempt would have been a little bit more Marvel Universe-y as opposed to, you know, the stuff that we actually got. I mean, the idea of doing some of the crazy, crazy stuff, you know, like stray toasters and such.
Yeah, it seemed pretty Marvel-focused at that point. You know, closer to what they were doing with Knights and Max, where they were doing mature readers out of continuity or half continuity kind of stuff, like soft continuity. Because Knights was still, I think Knights is still considered in continuity, right? I mean,
yeah, not that
Marvel looks back that often anymore.
Well, I think like Luke Cage, say, I mean, he had his series in
Alias.
Alias, and there was a Luke Cage miniseries that was a mature reader, so I forget which imprint it was on, but I know that it's part of continuity, so
yeah.
It was a Max book.
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, and Max is kind of Max is wishy-washy continuity, because the Punisher stuff wasn't. It was a self-contained continuity, and so was Nick Fury. Max was an odd line, but I mean, Epic had that tradition though of, you know, some of the, it's almost like it was in continuity if, you know, people bought it, like Elektra Lives.
Yeah, that's right.
If it sold well, then it was going to be in continuity. If not, like, you know, forget it ever happened.
What a marketing nightmare this line must have been. I mean, so much of it I actually do love, but at the same time, with no core books to promote and basically no crossovers, I can easily see how this line has failed multiple times. Unlike Vertigo, which you could sell a little bit together, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, Shadowline was the only attempt at a universe. I mean, they only had three titles. They lasted eight or ten issues or something each, and then there was a miniseries. I remember getting chunks of it, like from time to time. I would grab a bunch, and then I'd read some, and then I'd get rid of them, and then I'd grab a bunch when I forgot about having read them. I kept hoping for it to be more like the new universe, and I never got there.
Oh, yeah, you know, that would have been a great marketing title for it. Shadowline, not the new universe.
It's sort of like the new universe, but painted.
Yeah. That's awesome. What if the new universe were painted?
I don't know how much. Yeah, I don't know how much they actually published by that. I don't know the deal with Shadowline. Were they creator owned or were they like half owned?
Well, it was created by Archie Goodwin.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't know whether or not because he didn't write everything. I don't think. But yeah, it was created and edited by Archie Goodwin. So.
And actually, not all the books in the Epic line were actually creator-owned. I think it was the designation was creator-owned and mature imprint. And it was up to creators to create their own deal with Marvel, whether they own the characters or not. Because I know there's been a couple lawsuits with Marvel over stuff created for Epic.
Yeah, anytime that you're inventing the wheel like this, is you're going to make some mistakes as far as the contracts go. I mean, certainly there were a lot made, even into the 90s, there were mistakes like Angela, where things were done in handshakes that shouldn't have been. I don't know specifically any of the complaints that came up from that. I'm not sure if you know an example off the top of your head, Chris.
I believe there was a lawsuit involving Coyote. Mm. I know there was some trouble with Trouble off the top of my head, and I'm sure I read something else, but I don't have it right in front of me. Oh, I think Rick Veitch had an unpublished work that Marvel claimed some ownership of.
Oh, okay.
But even stuff like ElfQuest, that there was new material created for as well as reprints. Mm. I know for a fact that new material reverted back to the creator. It's included in a whole bunch of reprints that have since been done by DC and I believe Dark Horse right now. So.
Well, yeah, lots of them have been reprinted in other places, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I don't know if we want to get in that before we talk about specific titles or at the end, is just what's happened to some of this content since.
Probably at the end. I mean, we should...
Let's bookmark that.
Yeah, we should jump in, though.
Who wants to leap in with the first... The first one from the archives.
Well, I'll leave.
Before we do that, I just want to say, I mean, we're talking about how Vertigo wouldn't have existed, and I agree. But would Dark Horse have existed? Or Image in its current iteration? Or even just lines like Legend and Bravura from Malibu and those type of things? Like, all of it really stems back to this, doesn't it?
Well, Legend and Bravura, for sure.
Yeah, I think a few of those imprints, those two I would give you. I think Image was really working more on what had already been happening as far as independent comics was. Image did use a bit of this model for its first year when it piggybacked on Malibu's distribution. It was still, I would still say it was more in line with creator-owned, which was happening as separately from what Epic was doing.
Okay. All right. Well, let's, like I say, Brett, why don't you jump in?
Well, I'm going to start with something that we can then put into that bookmark for later. But my first bit that I'm going to talk about is Metropole by Ted McKeever, and I'll do Metropole AD as well. It was one of the... I think it actually might be my... No, it's not my first, but it was my first sketch from San Diego. I have Jasper Nauticord from Metropole by Ted McKeever. And, you know, I love this series so much. And in this case, it was great because I took the time to read it this last week. And I was just reminded by how absolutely batshit crazy Ted McKeever is. And you know, I'm always so happy when I finish reading his work, because it's good to know that there's some level of crazy out there who just keeps focusing his work into this kind of thing, like whether it's, you know, chickens or angels versus devils, and just it's nothing but crazy, but I truly love it. And in this case, it was reprinted in a wonderful collection on Comixology that, Keith, I know you were the one who pointed it out. I think it was like $4.99 for three massive volumes of Ted McKeever. And I think
they were so cheap.
And
yeah.
All of them, I believe.
Oh, God, I'm shopping now.
All of them, I believe, were from Epic. I think it's possible, because it had, maybe not, but Eddie Current was in there, Transit, and then the Metropole collection.
And there's 600 or 700 pages in one of them.
Metropole is over four. It's like 430. So I mean, just amazing, amazing run, and an amazingly brilliant reprint from. It's an Image reprint from Shadowline, oddly enough. But yeah, fantastic book.
I do love McKeever, and I don't know what the first McKeever I would have read outside of his mainstream was, because he did, you know, he did a couple issues of Legends of the Dark Knight, which is probably the first thing I saw.
Yeah, and that was after, because it was
quite a bit after.
Yeah, because in the Metropole, there's one page of or two pages of letters at the very end of the book, and he talks about some of the stuff that he's going on to do, and one of those is the Legends of the Dark Knight.
Right.
Well, without Epic, Ted McKeever, We could have saved him 30 years of misery, according to his most recent blogs.
Yeah.
That one line goes away. He doesn't get mainstream. Or as mainstream as Ted McKeever gets.
Yeah. He doesn't get work, period.
Yeah, that's right. And he only
does, and he can go on to do something productive. Yeah.
Imagine the 1980s cartoons we could have gotten if Ted McKeever had been working in animation instead of comics.
Oh, that would have been fantastic. I totally would have been there. Actually, that's the problem. I probably wouldn't have been there. I probably would have looked at it and thought, this is ugly. I can't do this. But you know, the second that you let your mind go and accept his crazy art and his crazy writing, then it's all good.
You know, it's funny. We're talking about these books, and we're going out our way not to describe the story, because I know none of us can actually capsulize what even genre these books happen to be in.
Oh no, I mean it's. It's like, the only way to encapsulate Metropole is like, it's almost like it's not steampunk, because but.
Oh, you're tempted to say some fucked up shit.
Well, yeah, it's
that doesn't cover it.
It's industrial angels versus demons, you know, and even that is only like 10% of the book.
Yeah, I think you'd be hard pressed to summarize Plastic Forks in a way that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, this just makes me want to go, and just, you know, if nothing else, Chris, your decision to bring this up has made me want to go through all of my Ted McKeever work. So that, I mean, that just makes me happy right there.
You know what? That was the goal.
Just for kicks, I pulled up Plastic Forks page on Comic Vine. Plastic Forks is the tale of a radical scientist working in the field of reproductive studies who has his own creation, a device that can turn anyone it is implanted inside into a self-impregnating new life form, used against him and taken from him for further development and inevitable perversion.
Right. It is right.
So knock yourself out on that.
Well, and the great,
how much drugs do you think? Like, how much do you think drugs are a part of his life? How, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how many drugs do you think Ted McKeever's taken?
all of them.
A million. I hope so. But at the same time, you know, all of it, it's so brilliant because all of it in its own way ties together. Like Metropole has a reference to plastic forks. It has Eddie Current. You know, it has like all of his work is like completely tied together in this, you know, all of his early work there. And it's just like, I don't even know how he does it because it, whether it's a small tie or a large tie, people can look completely different, but it's just like, it's the same. It doesn't matter.
It probably would have sold way better if he had referred to it as the McKeeververse.
Yes. That's... Yeah. If people would have understood that there is a continuity, albeit fucked up.
This has become a whole other podcast now.
Yeah, we could do a whole McKeever.
Oh, podcast, easily, sure. Easily. All right. Who's Brett getting on next?
All right, who's taking the next book?
I thought Brett was announcing it from what it was.
No, I'm not.
I was holding my breath in anticipation.
No, I'm not announcing that yet. But that's a yet.
Chris, it's your episode.
I'll throw one out. Okay, this book is for those of you that thought Frank Miller's Holy Night was too liberal.
This book
is for anyone who's ever read 2000 AD.
Oh,
and thought
I know what
Judge
it is.
Dredd is a winner.
I know what you're going. I know
this
what you're going for.
This book is for those of you who have read Garth Ennis's The Boys and thought, you know what, this book needs more sex and violence combined. The book I'm referring to, of course, is Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill's Martial Law.
Well, I mean, you talk about 2000 AD, and I mean, you got a couple of guys who came from 2000 AD, so, yeah.
You know what? This was probably, like, my fourth regular series of all time. So I was a young kid reading this. And I have to say, I didn't understand. It does. I didn't understand of all, but I knew there were lots of colors, lots of sex, and lots of violence.
And you know, the weirdest thing is that, like, the first issue does nothing to explain, well, it explains the series, but it does nothing to kind of illustrate what is going to come later in the series.
You know, my whole kind of exposure to martial law is simply the Martial Law versus Pinhead series from probably like 1993, 1994, in that range, or 92. And I knew a bunch of people were excited for it. And then I read it, and I'm like, it may have been the worst thing I ever read. So, I mean, now I'm going, well, I must have missed something somewhere.
Well, martial law is a bit of what you might call an acquired taste.
Yeah, and I mean, reading it as a youngster, I didn't get that it was satirical. Of course, I didn't get the depths of the profanity and the depths of the fascism going on. I mean, this is a man in a full body S&M / Nazi suit killing people for, I think it was 36 pages in the Epic Comics.
Yeah, it's long.
Killing superheroes. Now I read it, and I mean, I get all the little references, and there's hundreds, because every panel has hundreds of characters, it seems. Kevin O'Neill doesn't do lazy backgrounds. They're chock full. I don't know how he draws that much. And I mean, with the neon colors, and I mean, this is not a book that could exist in black and white. It just wouldn't make any sense if it made any sense to begin with. And I don't know if it's nostalgia, because I can go back now and read my Comixology copy, which
coincidentally, strangely, is published by DC. I can't figure that one out.
You know, I think the one thing that I'll say about it is that it really is a precursor to so many of the books that we've seen nowadays. Because, I mean, there's so much out there where it's just like, oh, you know, superheroes are bad. We're hunting the superheroes. And, I mean, that and Watchmen really are kind of precursors. I mean, Watchmen, obviously, in being the best thing ever in that regard. But martial law, just in that whole, you know, pure violence, pure, you know, Garth Ennis took so much from martial law.
And at the time, there was nothing like it on the market. I think that's what attracted me to it. That, and, well, at the time, it was big. Well, I still am a big fan of boobies, but I was willing to buy a comic book to support it.
If we didn't have a name for the episode, Mo. Hey, you know, Chris, it's just a suggestion.
I mean, you talk about you're a big fan of boobies. So, I mean, my first exposure to Epic Illustrated, I had a friend who was Epic Illustrated itself. Like, because I had a friend, he had an older brother who would go to the comic book shop, you know, and I didn't go to a comic book shop till I was in high school, like an actual comic book shop. You know, I went to a place that had some files and was a bookstore, used bookstore, and did some files, but it wasn't a true comic book shop, and it didn't have a lot of selection, you know. So, but he would go, and I mean, Epic Illustrated and Heavy Metal were two of the things that he would get. And when I would be over at my friend's house, then, you know, he'd leave it lying about, and I'd look through it, and it was very much like. And this is the precursor to the whole line. I mean, it was in like 1980, I think, that Epic Illustrated started running. And this is like the book that kind of led to everything, led to them starting the line. Because I know that it was creator-owned works within that book, and they would get royalties from the book, the creators, like that magazine, you know, doing these different things. I don't know if Heavy Metal works like that. Does it?
Heavy Metal is, I think it's all creator-owned, Heavy Metal.
I think so.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Because, yeah, Ferrer's had a couple of stories in there recently.
Well, this is it, yeah, Epic Illustrated, and that's how the line got started. I know that it was Archie Goodwin even doing that. Like, that was before. Like, the line, did he say it started in 84, Chris?
82.
I know the magazine started in 1980, because he had, like, a issue 3 or something like that. And I remember that. And, yeah, it blew my mind, because it was, like, that's the thing for me about Epic. Like, when I look at it, it was my first exposure to books that weren't just for kids, like Archie or Star Comics.
I'm disappointed. I thought you were going to say boobies.
Well, that too, Epic Illustrated. Like, yeah, but and Heavy Metal, you know, his Heavy Metal. But yeah, I mean, but also, I mean, yeah, the idea of comic books that were non-superheroes. So, I mean, Like he would, like I say, he would go, and his brother would buy him a couple books, and then he'd come over for sleepover, and he'd lend me his comics, and ElfQuest was one of those books, and so I read all this ElfQuest, and it blew my mind, because this wasn't Spider-Man, and like I didn't, and it wasn't Archie, and I hadn't read anything else like that, and the idea that the comic books could present different types of storylines, that's what Epic introduced me to.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I just want to say is that in Martial Law issue 6, there's a magazine which I think is a brilliant name for a show. The magazine that they have in there is called Knee Deep in Shit.
When we talk about the worst, something the worst something, we'll use that one.
Freedom Crushed While You Wait. There you go. But just
that alone is a great title.
Yeah, for sure.
And a great joke like that just wasted, because you know it's in a little corner of the panel, right?
Oh no, it is actually half the page.
Oh, okay, sorry, my bad.
But yeah, but the magazine cover definitely has a lot of random stuff. There's so much. If you open issue 6 and poke through it, you'll see like several things that will automatically offend you, especially if you're religious in any way, shape, or form.
I know it was the second to the bottom of my stack of comics every month when I brought them home into my parents' house. I always made sure that one was second to last. So a brief flip through and immediately out me as a pervert.
Yeah.
Now you're not worried about, you know, hiding that anymore.
Yeah, that's
no, now I know how to claim it's art legitimately.
All right, Keith, why don't you go?
Well, I'm going to talk about I'm going to bring up a book that we actually spoke about just a few short episodes ago with the author. Moonshadow was originally published at Epic.
That's right.
Ridiculously beautiful painted work by John J. Muth, written by what? How do you pronounce this name? J.M. DeMatteis wrote this.
DeMatteis.
There you go,
DeMatteis.
Bastard.
So, amazing fairy tale work that came out from Epic and was later. Later collected at Vertigo, they published an extra chapter called Farewell Moonshadow, which as JM told us when we interviewed him, he his view of the character changed as the story went along. So he by the time he got to Farewell Moonshadow, he no longer believed that this was a true story. So it gives it an interesting addendum that it didn't have when it was originally published, but just that a place existed for a work like Moonshadow to be a 12 issue maxi series. You know, we talked about other works that have been like Seekers into the Mystery, which, you know, had a plan and then they couldn't make it because the sales weren't there. To actually set out to do this, like this book, like it was nothing like it on the shelves, and commit to, you know, this full run. There was no company that existed that could have done that. I mean, you know, I do talk about creator owned was around, but no one was going to do 12 issues as a commitment on a creator owned book in 1985.
Yeah. The reason we still have this book today coming out from Vertigo and now coming out in I think 2017 and a new volume from somebody is because Epic, you know, Epic gave it enough of a life, enough of a visibility that it's been able to continue to develop over the years. And I think that's well put, Keith. Yeah, I mean, you know, nobody else would have done it.
Since we talked to JM, I've had this reoccurring dream of actually reading this book on my iPad. just to see the main character, how the moon is going to shine out from my pad. I think it's going to be a more powerful experience to actually have light, like the backlight on this beautiful work. This is a book I'm greatly anticipating. And one of the few I'm not going to wait for a sale on, that's just a buy now.
So yeah, just in a remarkable work. I do hope it, I hadn't heard of any new reprint, but maybe that might be one of the ones Dover's doing, because Dover's is the one that's doing.
He mentioned it during the podcast.
Yeah, well, Dover's doing the last one, so hopefully that's the publisher of it then, because they do beautiful editions. All right, someone else can leap in now.
I think it's Mo's turn.
Mo.
Well, I just went with ElfQuest. So
ElfQuest was your choice. I had no idea.
You said like 10 different titles.
Yeah, yeah.
I said ElfQuest and Epic Illustrated.
Well, Sprint's turn. Go ahead.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've realized from this affair as well is that when I look at my shelves of trade paperbacks and you know, and the like, the volume of work that either, you know, that came from Epic is actually astronomical. You know, I have Dreadstar, I have the Ted McKeever, I got the Plastic Forks, You know, if I look down, there's, you know, Electra Lives Again. I got Stray Toasters over there. You know, it's just, I have that Iron Man one that I forget exactly the name. I just picked up The Trouble with Girls actually from a dollar store. Unbelievably, but
that's unusual.
Yeah, I know, right? You know, and it's just, these are books that have survived however many culls down the line, and it's incredible, but they're still here, and that's again another testament to how great so many of these books are. I really was struggling because I considered The Light and Darkness War because I thought it was a really good one down the line. But I think I'm going to go, and of course Coyote, because, you know, Engelhardt's work is great. I'm going to go with Stray Toasters because, you know, Bill Sienkiewicz is an amazing artist. And again, the work is just completely crazy. But for me, again, it goes along with one of the stories when I was in San Diego and I had picked up the trade paperback of Stray Toasters and I was going to have Bill sign it, and he was sitting at his desk and he's crazy. He's like, he's just being crazy in person. And all I can think of is this, like, okay, I just want you to sign my book that I've picked up. But he starts doing this sketch. And I'm thinking, this is awesome. I'm getting a Bill Sienkiewicz sketch in this book. And then some guy from Virgin comes over, and Bill completely ignores me to talk to this guy from Virgin. And now, as we know right now, I am obviously more important in the comic book industry than anybody from Virgin Comics. But, you know, Bill is like, what he would do is he would draw a line. And then he would talk, and I was just like. And so he would just kind of draw a line, get me excited that he was going to finish it, and keep talking. And this went on for like 15 minutes of staring at him, attempting to draw this. And in the end, he wound up drawing this really wacky piece of toast in my book. But the truth is that, you know, I love this book, and I love the fact that Bill Sienkiewicz ignored me and drew a piece of toast in my copy of it.
It's a great story. It's a great, great story. You know what? I've never read that.
I thoroughly recommend it.
Yeah, tell him what's it about.
I think the story revolves around criminal psychologist Egon Rustamagic and his investigation of a serial killer who seems to be targeting women. There you go. That's the Wikipedia one. I don't think it's possible to go into anything deeper because, let's see, Dr. Montana Violet, a crazed cyanotic scientist who is slowly degenerating, is fed by birds, is mechanically bound to a throne, and tends to use quotations.
Wasn't that on Bones last week?
Bones is still on the air?
I have no idea.
And Stray Toasters, what? Yeah, the narrator is Satan. So so just in case, just again, I've gone with the completely batshit crazy, and,
oh,
you know.
People are going to be going, like, anybody's listening to this who was like, oh, let me hear about this line of books. Maybe I'll check it out. Now they're sitting there going, well, maybe not. like turning people off. Let's go with one that's a little more, I think people would have a little more, easier to digest for a lot of people, but it's still brilliant. And you know, I'm a huge fan of Jim Starlin. How about Dreadstar? How about the incredible space opera Dreadstar, that if you love his, you know, space oddities that he's done for Marvel and DC, then, you know, check out his own series. It's just spectacular.
I got that on the shelf too. That is reprinted by Slave Labor Graphics.
Oh, yeah, it's been reprinted by a couple people, yeah. I think.
Actually, the Comixology edition is by IDW.
All right. Well, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I was thinking they were the ones holding it right now, yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. I don't have a good story about Jim Starlin blowing me off while he's signing my book, Brett. But it's a great story. It's a great comic.
Well, not everybody can have that stuff.
Have any of us actually met Starlin?
No.
Because I think there's some good Jim Starlin blowing people off stories out there, from what I hear. Just we have none on this podcast, which is amazing. Usually there's one of us.
No, I've not come across him in all the various shows I've done.
No, he seems to be relatively, well hidden from us. But that's okay. We'll find him.
I'm trying to get over the exact sentence. There's some good Jim Starlin blowing people off stories out there. I haven't quite digested this yet.
That was a little bit more erotic than I actually intended.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
But you know what?
There goes any chance they're having him on a podcast. Thanks, Chris. Yeah.
So you're assuming that he doesn't do comic conventions, but he does listen to our show.
Yeah, of course.
Hi, Jim.
He knows I'm a fan.
Breed was cool.
Star. Breed was awesome. Man, Breed, I'd love to do something on that.
Now, Mo, I'm curious. I'm also a Dreadstar fan. Now, do you like, if you could only have one, would you choose the Epic series where, you know, Odie was introduced and they became a team? Or would you have the origin story, which is very different, originally published in Epic Illustrated?
Oh,
if you could only have one, which way would you go?
Oh man, that's you know what? I got to go with that. The art in that Epic Illustrated origin story is just so blow away. I think I got to go with that. I think so. It's just based on how gorgeous it looks.
You know what? I'm the opposite, but it's just because the later half of the series has that like Star Wars space opera feel.
Yeah, it has that. Yeah, for sure.
That says 80s to me for some reason, and I get nostalgic about it. But quality-wise, I think they're both there. But it's really interesting now you have the same creator doing basically the same character, and the feel is so different in two parts of one story.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a good point. Somebody jump in. Keith, what else you got?
All right. Well, you talk about books that I think that people would love today. I want to talk about a book that Twitter would hate. Twitter would just attack this book.
Unlike martial law.
Yeah.
Unlike,
wait. I will give you money if you can name a book now that Twitter likes.
Is Spider-Gwen is still coming out, right? that seems to be fine. I found it in trade paperback from DC. Peter David and George Perez, Sax and Violence.
Oh, yes.
Which was part of the Heavy Hitters line, which was the Rego Epic went to. Epic.
That's on my list, Keith. That's on my list. I love that. Yeah, I love it.
I gave this a reread. It reminded me a lot, actually, of John Sable, just in the style of it, the gritty, like street level. It is a nude model, implied that she's also does pornography, as well as nude cheesecake. And her photographer friend, who's a Vietnam vet, they go up against a company that makes snuff films and kiddie snuff films. There's ridiculous violence, tons of nudity, the inner workings of the porn industry. lots of swearing, children getting their hands cut off.
So good.
So good. And let's say it's not sex and violence. It's sax and violins.
Sax and violins. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
I'm just gonna say that that it would end up as a hashtag that there is a villain named Rug Muncher. probably wouldn't.
I guess we couldn't do a PG-13 episode talking about Epic. Apparently, but I love that. Like Perez, you're used to seeing Perez do beautiful superhero art, and the style isn't that different. But the gloves are off, and it could be his best ever work.
It is near the peak of his career, and it's before his work became almost overworked with the rubble and the yeah. detail. It's only a few characters, so it's not overwhelmed the way an Avengers book by him would be. The art is just gorgeous on this book.
Like, spectacular. Great.
Storytelling is so, like the storytelling by Perez is so beautiful.
And it's got that. I mean, if you like Peter David is known for his sense of humor. If you like it, again, this is it. Gloves off.
And Perez inks himself on the first two and part of the third issue, which is quite unusual as well. That he finished the work as well as penciling. So yeah,
I always thought there was going to be another volume of that. There's only the one volume, I believe.
He brought Peter David brought the characters back in Fallen Angels.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, okay. Perez didn't. He and Perez had talked about it for years. I was doing some reading on this. It's in the foreword to the trade paperback that the two of them owned the characters. He was doing Fallen Angels, got permission from Perez to include those two characters as recurring later on in Fallen Angels.
Okay, I always wondered if they had some sort of falling out or something like that. But yeah,
no, just busy. Like just
weren't they at the same expo here a few years ago? Weren't they at the same one here in Calgary? That would have been the time to ask them.
I don't think they were at the same one, but
no,
they've both been to the expo. I don't know if it's the same year though.
I thought it might have been. Maybe not. Maybe not. Like, I tell you this, I never saw them at the same place either.
Yeah.
Except if they were at the expo, because then I would have seen them in the same place.
At opposite ends.
Given Perez's line for sketches, there's no way that he went anywhere else that week.
Oh, yeah, I know. It was unbelievable. We've seen a lot of legends, a lot of Marvel Comics legends come, but nobody with a line like Perez had.
Yeah, Perez was doing Head and Shoulders sketches and chatting with people too. He's an incredible dude. That's the longest I've ever waited in a line at a comic show. I'm notorious for hating lines and giving up. 90 minutes I waited to get a sketch for Perez, and he's just an amazing dude.
Worth every second, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
I waited in line for Bill St. Kevin's. The line was me.
The line was you, but you're still waiting 90 minutes.
Still waited 90 minutes, yeah.
Just staring at Bill.
Now, Keith, you alluded to it in the intro. Wasn't there some sort of controversy? I don't remember the details between Peter David and I think it was Todd McFarlane about this book.
It wasn't about this book. There is a dig at McFarlane hidden in the art. That the fourth issue takes place at Mardi Gras, and there's someone's wearing a T-shirt that says "We'll trade beads for Spawn number one." this would have been around the time that McFarlane and. The days before the internet, it's hard to explain to someone that that Peter David and Todd McFarlane had an argument by mail in the early 90s.
Well, and they had that debate at San Diego, I believe, where it was,
it started
what's more important, the comic book writer or the comic book artist? And Peter David essentially just destroyed him during the debate.
And fashion violence sold $4.
Exactly. And it was also in the same time feuding with Eric Larson of Savage Dragon.
It started when Peter David had a regular column in Comics Buyer's Guide, which was a magazine, a tabloid-sized paper that was printed at the time. And his column was called But I Digress. And he started taking some jabs at Image. This was the early days of Image. And then there was some letters back and forth. And then it culminated in a in-person debate that McFarlane thought was really a jape, and Peter David showed up ready to actually debate.
My favorite of all of these, though, wasn't the shot, the one that spawned, though, that's pretty good. It's the one, though, during issue of the Hulk, and it was Gary Frank doing the art at the time, where the Hulk had to go undercover. And so he went into a room and came back with a fin on his head. And do you remember this guy? And it said, everyone can clearly see that's just the Hulk with a fin on his head. Come on. Awesome. Friggin' awesome. All right, let's do another epic book. Somebody throw something out there.
Well, an interesting one for me is again, we talked to J.M. DeMatteis, and we brought up Blood, A Tale, another epic book that you know, inspired our first short film and such, and is, you know, beautiful art, a wonderful book, and just, you know, again, another one of those things that I own, but just another more proof that, you know, there's just, especially like certain writers seem to keep coming back, and J.M. DeMatteis was one of those, but, you know, just so many quality books, you know, I'm blown away. But Alien Legion, another fantastic book that was published through Epic as well. Reprinted from Dark Horse.
And, you know, when we talk about Epic, like you say, I wasn't going to the comic book stores until I was in high school. Even then, I didn't go a whole ton. But, so, I mean, I was mainly, off the news rack guy, you know, back when you could actually do that. And one of the few Epic books that was on there, and it ended up with 125 issues. I think that's got to be the longest, the most Epic run in Epic history. It's got to be GRU, right?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a long stretch where GRU was the only Epic book.
Yeah. At 125 issues.
Yeah.
And, I mean, again, talk about ElfQuest. GRU is another one where it's like, okay, the comics can be something different. They can be, like, it's opening my eyes, you know, those early days reading it, and just still one of my favorite books of all time. And that 125 issues is, I mean, I'm telling you, 100 jokes or 100 episodes with one joke and 25 with a second joke. They kept it fresh.
Yeah, he really branched it right
out. Come on.
It's
just
brilliant.
The GRU is still running, and they haven't got any new jokes. So
they went back to the first joke. When those 25 issues where he got smart weren't as popular, then they went back to making him stupid for no explanation. They just, he was stupid again, and back to the one joke. It was great. But I love me some GRU. So, you know, when I think of Epic, that's the one I think of.
Video Jack, Kerry Bates and Keith Giffen. That's another great one.
Indeed. I actually meant when Chuck Dixon was on the show to bring up Car Warriors.
Yes, absolutely.
I was... beautiful art. Phil Winslade, I want to say, did the art.
Yeah, he did. He did.
And
or did he do the? He might. It might not have been the art. He might.
Oh, he did the. Inking. Sorry, Phil Winslade did the. The inks, and it was Steve Dillon that did.
Yeah.
The
so I mean, it's, you know, back when Dillon was good.
you mean every minute that Steve Dillon's ever drawn, including today. that's when Steve Dillon was good.
That's fighting words right there. Let's go. This is better. Let's go off on a sidebar. Brett, your point of view.
Steve Dillon got lazy about 5 years ago and started drawing every face exactly the same.
Keith, your rebuttal.
John Byrne's always drawn every face the same.
Yes, but John Byrne had way more going on than Steve Dillon does.
The current Punisher book is awesome. Steve Dillon.
This is I was expecting Punisher. A little more passion and fighting here. All right, looks we'll move exactly on.
Like nobody draws a head exploding the way that Steve Dillon does.
No,
he's the master of someone getting shot in the head.
Ah, Liefeld. Like if there's one thing that he does well, I mean, he puts stuff in. I mean, stuff comes out of the brain when it explodes that doesn't exist in a head, but it's certainly very inventive.
So anyway, what I played the game Car Wars, which was a role playing game, when I was in high school, and this book came out just right in that time. This was a 4-issue miniseries that tied to the game and gave you something in the book in the comic would then be given to you as a playable thing in the Car Wars game. Like they would design they would give you a weapon or design a vehicle, that kind of thing. I have a soft spot for this book, as well as, you know, some of the earliest work by the master Steve Dillon. I want to make sure how are we doing on time?
Oh, we're close.
All right. Close. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you guys, you know, something that wasn't Epic related. So,
well, let's kind of, I wanted to get back to now we talked about a lot of these books, and we've also, you know, we've mentioned the ones that we've got collected. Times change and editorial changes. The Marvel's commitment to creator own really seems to stop at Mark Miller these days. Most of these books that are collected by someone else.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Many of these were kind of before, I mean, really Watchmen started the heyday of trade paperbacks, and a lot of this stuff came out before that. Sex and Violence is DC. Moonshadow is Vertigo. Quite a bit of this stuff had been was reprinted by Vertigo. IDW now has collected a significant amount of this. Actually, is IDW. Alien Legion's been collected by two or three different companies now. It is just it's interesting to me how these things change, and I don't know if it'll ever change back. I don't know if it is a cycle or if it was just. That was a time. What are your thoughts? Like, do you see a time that Marvel could publish an Epic again?
Didn't they try? I mean, Bendis did that Brilliance book, and you know, what was the name of that line? That was just a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
that's still Icon. That was the Mark Millar reference Keith made.
Yeah, Icon. Yeah, Icon.
JMS
Icon
was an Icon.
Yeah. Icon was set up to publish creator-owned, and then within a pretty short time, Mark Miller seems to be the only one that actually publishes anything under it.
I thought Bendis was still publishing under it.
I
was underneath there, and
I think it just exists so they can keep people who want to do independent work still under the exclusive Marvel contract. Mm. They're not looking for independent titles at all.
They don't want a Hickman going over to Image.
No, exactly. With
these, so they give them a chance to do this, is what you're thinking.
Yeah, I think it's just to sublimate their in-house talent. I don't think it's made. It's even built as a business, really, from what I've seen.
Yeah, I don't see Marvel getting back into it, Keith, for the simple fact that when Marvel did this before, there was a need.
Mm.
And I don't think that need exists now. In that same way, if they were to get into doing it now, they'd have to compete with all these other companies that are still doing quite well doing this type of thing. So, I mean, I don't know why you'd want to do
that. Yeah, there's no point in becoming the like small player in the creator-owned space when you know that, you know, Image is easily number one. And so it's very hard to compete with that.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and you do look. I mean, Vertigo kind of had that problem. I mean, they tried the big relaunch, and there was nothing. Quality aside, like I'm not talking about the quality of books, but there was nothing story wise or idea wise that wouldn't have fit at five other publishers. So what's the reason for Vertigo?
It's a different world. Yeah, it's a different world. That's the thing.
I would love though a place where, because I.
although I think there's a place for independent books out there, there's nowhere that an artist can spend a little bit of time and get the upfront cash to make something, say, like Moonshadow or the Buzz Chronicles. That,
are you sure that there isn't? Because I know a couple publishers that do that, so...
I can't think of any off the top of my head. I'd love to hear what
Renegade Arts Entertainment.
What I was actually referring to was painted work.
Yeah, John Bolton doesn't paint.
yeah, I suppose. Yeah, he's established. I was thinking more unknown, but you're right. You're right. It does exist there.
It does exist, and I'm sure that's not that's. I mean, I we know the publisher, which is why we know the business model, and they're not shy about it. But I'm sure it's not the only one.
Yeah, maybe it's just nostalgia talking. When I could go and pick up two books a month in a very artistic style, and now I'm not finding. I mean, there's plenty of independence and. I guess there's just more comics now, so it's my fault for not looking hard enough.
Well, and I think that, I mean, more so now, creators are their own brand. I mean, back at the time that Epic was coming out, that Epic published by Marvel Comics had a lot of weight, in the same way that, you know, Vertigo published by DC Comics had a lot of weight. And I don't know that it does anymore, because really you're driven by the creators who are their own brand, as opposed to, you know, needing that seal of quality of that, you know, lowercase e in the corner of Epic. So you can have someone like John Bolton, who's, you know, off working on at a company that, you know, publishes a couple of graphic novels a year. You know, fantastic work. It's not a big shop, but he can do it, work at his own pace, and the books come out when he's ready for them to come out. Because, and people buy them because of John Bolton.
Well put.
Yeah, thank you. I worked on that.
I
rehearsed that a couple of times. I workshopped it with other people before I did this podcast.
I would have expected to be better, Keith.
Suddenly it's not that good.
Really? The guy that I had playing you at the workshop was not great, I'll be honest.
Yeah. There's only one me.
All right. Thank God. Let's get ready to wrap this sucker up.
Yeah, let's wrap it up. I just want to get a real quick film review from you guys, because you guys went to a screening. I'm curious.
Just before you do that, can I get a couple last words on Epic?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just go ahead.
Just because we briefly talked about ElfQuest, but I couldn't let it go by. ElfQuest is one of my favorite series of all time. I strongly endorse it. Just if anyone's unsure, it's like Bone with more implied orgies.
So,
in other words, have to buy this book. One of my favorites.
More.
It was like my second love of comics after Secret Wars. If Secret Wars was,
we must have read a different ElfQuest. Like.
Yeah, there's orgies. You have to wait till like issue 4, but it's there.
I read a lot of ElfQuest. That's not at all. Chris, I think almost every book you seem to put in something like that because you just wanted it to be part of it.
No. There are orgies in ElfQuest. I can guarantee.
I'll fight you over this. There are orgies in ElfQuest.
Mm-hmm. This is the best episode ever.
All right.
Oh my!
Last words is ElfQuest orgies. I can't.
But anyway, anyway, go out, buy ElfQuest. It, no hesitation in that recommendation. And there were orgies.
Okay, guys, movie review time. Brett, Keith.
Yo. So we saw, Brett and I went to the one-day screening of Batman Return of the Caped Crusaders, which is the Batman 66 animated movie. And holy crap, is that a lot of fun.
Oh, man, is it ever. It's, because it's everything you love about Batman 66 with, you know, updated sensibilities in that regard, updated humor and references to, you know, any number of Batman like movies, you know, TV, anything like that. So it's kind of like everything you could possibly want in Batman 66 in one 90-minute episode. And Adam West as a bad guy, no less, you know.
Yeah, there's a couple of I only caught two. I don't know if they did more. A couple of funny references to other screen Batmans. A lot of in jokes for fans of the original, but not overdone, so that if you're bringing someone that's never seen it, they're not distracting. Like, they don't stop the plot to give you the in joke. It was quite and great to hear Adam West and Burt Ward doing those voices
again. Oh, absolutely.
Just ridiculous. What was the warning on it? It was PG for.
I don't even remember.
It was violence and wacky humor or something like that. Was
awesome.
Yeah, highly recommend. It's out. It's out on demand, and then shortly, and then a week or two later on DVD and Blu-ray. And they do actually hint in the there's a making of that they played with the film when we saw it that says that that there are likely to be more of these if it does well.
So, I hope it does. Excellent. I'm looking forward to watching it. So go out and buy it, and we're gonna go OU2 in this episode. But first off, I get to announce next week's episode.
Huzzah!
And I'm going to do one where Brett can't schedule an interview over it because he gets excited. I have so many ideas. I really need us to probably start doing at least 5 podcasts a week just to get to all my show ideas. But I'm going to go. We're going to call next week's episode 168 the We Talk Comics Super Special, because we're going to be talking about Marvel Comics Super Specials. There were a series of adaptations of movies back in the late 70s to early 80s. Here are some of the movies or adaptations, and not all of them, actually. They had one, Star-Lord, for instance, had a book obviously that's not an adaptation. Not all of these are, but here's some of the ones that we're not doing that I considered. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Jaws 2. Because you know that would have been great.
That would have been great. Jaws 3?
No, it wasn't in there. Xanadu, and that's adapted by our buddy JM.
JM is very proud of that because he says he's the who's the famous star? Is it Fred Astaire that's in that? In Xanadu.
Yes, it is Fred Astaire.
Yeah. I just know Olivia John.
Yeah, he said he's the only person to ever write a comic book with Fred Astaire in it.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Because he did the adaptation.
Well, I kind of wish I picked it, but I didn't. Raiders of the Lost Ark, For Your Eyes Only. Runner.
For Your Eyes Only was my introduction to James Bond. That was the first. I'd never seen one of the films. I read the adaptation was the first thing I read.
Blade Runner, Annie. Adapted by Tom DeFalco, Annie.
the music loses something, I'll be honest.
Well, you just wait. The Dark Crystal. Here's one I came so close to picking. You talk about the music losing something. Rock and Rule.
How did you Bill not Mantlo choose
that? Adapted. Rock and
Rule. That's an awesome movie.
It's a Canadian classic right there.
I know. But, you know, it won't adapt. So, Last Starfighter, Muppets Take Manhattan, Buckaroo Banzai, Sheena, Dune, and 2010, also done by JM, and Santa Claus the Movie. These are, and Labyrinth. Those are some of the ones I did not pick, but I almost did.
These are
the ones that we're going to go with. Okay. What's that? Are you gonna?
I just want to quickly say that I have Dune is the only one I have in hard copy, And Bill Sienkiewicz did the art on that. And I showed it to, I got him to sign it at a show. And he's, and I had one of those awkward moments of standing there while he went through it. Because he hadn't seen that edition, and he had, in either had never seen it or had not seen it in many years, didn't remember having seen the super special version.
That's right. Ralph Macchio and Sienkiewicz did the adaptation. So that's interesting. But okay, so we're not doing that. okay, so here's what we're doing. We're doing the very first one, which is Kiss. But in this one, Kiss fights Dr. Doom.
I'll bet you I have that in my Kiss compendium.
Oh, you do.
My 500 billion pages of Kiss weighs.
It is written by Steve Gerber.
Oh, yeah, I'm almost.
The legendary Steve Gerber with John Buscema on art and Sal Buscema. So that's one of the ones we're going to talk about.
After the foreword, the first thing, Marvel Kiss Classic, Kiss Super Special, number one.
It's their first one. Nice. First one for them, and first. So number four, the fourth Marvel Super Specials that ever came out was the Beatles story. And George Perez does some of the art on that.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, so we're going to be doing that one. We're going to be doing one that was unpublished in in America. Published here in Canada, unpublished in America, though. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And George Perez is also doing some art on that one. That's actually the seventh one. And we're going to jump all the way to the end, the very last book, which is the very last movie adaptation, is adapted by Danny Fingeroth and Kyle Baker. Yes, that Kyle Baker. And it's Howard the Duck.
Oh, boy.
This is going to be a super special, too. It's going to redefine. It might be a super duper special.
I love it. I can't wait to read these.
All right. I got copies of them for you guys. So anything else, guys? Or are we done on this sucker?
I will have you know, although I can't find a picture, the ElfQuest Wikipedia page has the entire chapter entitled Orgies.
Yeah, but did you just write it? I mean, you can edit that yourself. That's why he was quiet for a couple minutes.
Yeah. No, it was. I was trying. I was looking it up though.
All right, hold on. Hold on. People are going to want me to verify. All right, here we go. Adaptation. I don't see anything. Publication history, Warp Graphics, other media, Marvel, DC. You're full of shit. Background and setting. Where is it, Chris? The Wolf Riders, the Sun Folk. I see nothing about fucking.
This is a fantastic podcast right here.
Chat, Chris, there's nothing in here about orgies.
Are you sure you're
on ElfQuest and not SexQuest?
Do you have Safe Search on, Mo? Because that might be filtered out.
In Wikipedia? And do you think I would have Safe Sex on? I mean, we've met, right? Okay, let's talk about the orgy. You're right, there was one.
Mo, actually, if you continue going, the Go Backs orgy is literally the last section on the ElfQuest page on Wikipedia.
Oh, is it?
you have to scroll all the way to the bottom.
Oh, there it is. Oh my God, the Go Backs orgy.
We're calling it after that, too.
The Go Backs orgy. I got to reread this book.
Oh, we're only two episodes away from episode 169.
There you go.
And perfect. This is ideal.
That will be my episode.
Yes. Just a suggestion, then, Brett.
I'm just saying we might have to go out of order for 1 week, Brett.
We'll call it. Right. We'll theme it orgies in comics that you didn't know.
Oh yeah, I can all right. Let's wrap this sucker up. Again. Good night.
Good night, guys.